We've got another half an hour for questions, and I suspect we might fill that half hour. So can I ask for questions?
So I'm Callum. I'm on the MSc Education course.
Hi,
Denver. One thing I was interested in was the you're talking about the internet and sort of like kind of transfer of knowledge and stuff.
Yeah.
And when I finished my bachelor's, I felt like I'd paid quite a lot of money to be trained in remote learning, like having a library access and an internet and a password to get into like online journals and stuff. And when I left, I went teaching in Thailand and I set up a charity in Uganda. When I needed the knowledge, when I needed to search these databases for like practical sort of like good work, I couldn't do them, and I couldn't afford to pay the money to get the information.
That's
and I found it really interesting that the universities as a whole, as a kind of elite, kind of it feels like they hold on to the knowledge. You know, the knowledge is created and contained, and it's not transferred unless there's a sort of a formal right not to sign up and go in this course and do this. And I mean, practically speaking, I mean, like if I could pay a subscription to my first university and say, you know, £15 a year, because I can go into the library and I can take the books out as an alumni, but I can't access,
access
where
them.
I need it. And I thought that, I don't know if you have any comments on
that. Well, thank you very much. And that, you know, that's very interesting that you would say that, because when we started doing our consultations in Victoria about whether or not there would be, should we have an office of community-based research, or, you know, what the community wanted to do, we had exactly someone just like you said 6 months ago. I was a student, he was in sociology. I was a student of sociology, I've finished, you know, now I'm working as a researcher for the community council here in Victoria. They want me to do research and find out this, that, and the other. I now, 6 months later, I can't get access to the databases, the electronic journals and all the stuff that you can get that I could get 6 months ago. What are you going to do about it? So we actually, in that case, for Victoria, for our local region, we actually negotiated an agreement with the library, and we've created a thing called a community scholar. And as long as, so any number of people can be admitted as community scholars, all they have to be is somebody from the university that's in the, you know, the academic staff just have to, you know, write a note or something like that. And so we've opened that up. But that's exactly the issue that you've raised is part of this discourse around this access to knowledge movement. Because there are the space of universities, higher education spaces, like all spaces in society, are spaces of contestation. And so you've got all kinds of people. The market is trying to get one thing, and, you know, sort of democratic knowledge sharers are trying to get something else. So within the knowledge world, there's a big race to, you know, intellectual property rights. We face it in our journals. We have to sign, I signed just the other day for the London Review of Education, a release saying that I didn't own the review that I did, but it is owned by those guys. They're going to sell that. And I don't mean that they're going to get a lot of money from my book review, but, you know, that's... They are licensing all of our ideas. So you know, we have to be aware that this is an area of contestation. And I think that the issue that you raise is a brilliant example, of one of the things that it wouldn't take so much work for us to change. Now, what the libraries say is, well, we get our licenses at a reduced rate because it's a closed system. It's only our students and university. But there's not hundreds of thousands of people like yourself. And the little bit of manipulation, the librarians, we have found, they love people to use the stuff, even the electronic stuff. I think it's a matter of having some meetings.
Thanks very much, Bud. That was great, as usual, and always very inspiring. lots of food for thought there and lots of good ideas, I think. I'm just curious a wee bit to find out a bit more of your thinking on calling it a knowledge movement. I'm working my way through this thing because I think, you know, I know you're very committed to kind of liberatory education type ideas, whereas, so I'm thinking maybe you would, and you mentioned yourself that maybe we should be calling it learning or something like this, and I just wonder why knowledge, because in some ways, I think there's a lot, if your views about helping communities towards emancipation, liberation, a more just world and all the rest of it, there's lots of already, I mean, I don't think it's a question of acquiring new knowledge so much. There's lots of really important stuff already out there. And obviously, knowledge as well, you know, all the best knowledge that the world has accumulated is used for good purposes and bad purposes. So knowledge in its own is a kind of fairly, in some ways, fairly neutral term, I think. And I just wondered a wee bit behind that, why you focused on the idea of a knowledge movement as, say, I mean, is there a particular reason for that? I'm not criticizing it. I'm just trying to think through it. Right?
That's a great question, Liam. And I as I say, I'm really trying to think through it myself. I'll tell you one of the reasons why it's come to me. It's because in the last 4 years, I've been in this kind of this higher education world where, you know, and Michael was talking about it, where our, you know, we hear all about knowledge transfer, knowledge mobilization, knowledge exchange. It's a part of the. It's an important part of the, you know, pro-vice chancellor's research, and sometimes vice chancellors themselves, you know, as they try to maneuver and create space for higher education and negotiate with, you know, other interests in society. So it's come to me because I realize that there's a lot of attention being played to to a knowledge discourse, but I found when I try to think about, well, how do the traditions, practices, you know, and history and so forth that I come from, how do they fit into a knowledge discourse? And I'm not satisfied to just be part of the knowledge economy discourse. And I don't think that the knowledge society discourse is explicit enough to incorporate a very explicitly values-based kind of approach, and so I got the idea really from John Gaventa. I don't know if some of you will know John. He's at Sussex. He's a political scientist who's done a lot of international work and done a lot of work on understanding, you know, power and powerlessness, you know, in vulnerable societies. I'll give you the example the first example that I learned from him. He was, at the time, he wasn't at Sussex, he was in Appalachia, the U.S., and he was involved, he was working in a small, Highlander Center, it's called. It's a adult education and research center that supports local struggles. And he got involved in the what was called a citizens research project on land ownership in the Appalachian region. And so, you know, why was that important? Well, what they discovered, Appalachia is a part of the United States. It's very rich in resources. Some people are making a hell of a lot of money out of that part of the world, but the people living there are poor as church mice. And so what's the problem is that the land is owned by people who are living in New York, they're living in London, I don't know, maybe even in Edinburgh, maybe even Glasgow, I don't know. But they're absentee landlords. And they have fought to keep the taxes down and everything, and health and safety regulations down, so they can maximize profits, so that the states and the counties and so forth, they don't have any money for poor, you know, to help provide a kind of safety net in health and unemployment and all of those things. So what John did at working with others is they actually just trained citizens, ordinary people in the community, to go to the courthouses and find out who owns the land. And they did it. They had to do it in 7 states. They didn't have, you know, it wasn't a multinational corporation. They had to do it on citizens as volunteers. And he talked about that as using knowledge as an organizing strategy. You know, they could have had a demonstration. They could have, which they might well have. They could have been supporting a miners' strike, which they also would have done. But added to the kind of change strategy was this idea of using knowledge as a campaigning, as an action strategy. And they were able to get legislative changes in 4 out of the 7 Appalachian states as a result of that. So I'm trying to think about. How can we articulate, learning knowledge. It may be better to use learning, but I'm sort of working a little bit around the knowledge side because it seems so topical. And all these, you know, everybody seems to be talking about it. So I'm trying to think about how to talk about it in a way that is more inherently democratic and more where the value orientations might be more clearer than they would be in the other two.
Hi, my name's Dave Beck. I'm a lecturer in community development here. And so I'm kind of very with you on the approach and the idea of universities resourcing community movements, community organizations. The difficulty for me is I work in an organization that's funded to do teaching and returnable research, and there's a very strong and kind of, you know, clearly delineated line about all of that sort of stuff. And so while my aspirations and my kind of my passion and my heart would be to do exactly what you're talking about, the kind of the direction and the demands are to do stuff that will position this organization as a global university, yeah, without that much of a connection, really, I don't think, to the local. And so it's a real kind of, this is great, but it's hugely countercultural as far as I'm kind of experiencing it. Any ideas what we can do about that?
Yes, yes. What you're expressing is actually the reality for most, you know, people, most academic staff, you know, in universities. Vast majority of them are even those who are doing something differently are experiencing that. You know, what I think, I'll tell you what we did at the University of Victoria. We simply organized a symposium. We called it community-based research, kind of an umbrella term. You know, it covers a lot of things. And it's and we invited anybody in the university to show up, and we got about almost 25%, you know, of the academic staff in our university out to a meeting like that. Now, I don't know whether that would work, you know, in other places. It was called by the Pro Vice Chancellor of Vice of Research. So that gave it, you know, people realized that it had. And we selected some kind of leaders in that kind of work to, you know, to give talks and all of that. But it produced a lot of energy. And then what we did in our university, the Pro Vice Chancellor for Research, he said, wow, there's a lot going on here. What they discovered is that that two-thirds of the people that identified as doing this kind of work, engaged scholarship, were, you know, untenured academic staff, younger, newer to the university, and three-quarters of that group were women. So the university felt that, well, we need to do something to, you know, also not to take away from the other, you know, the kind of the world university kind of research, not to take away, but we do need to do something to support these people who are here making a career as well. And so they created a task force to study better how to support this kind of work, and the particular structure that they came up with was the one I told you a little bit about. We did, I was the co-chair of that task force. What we did is we went all around the world. You know, we looked for every example that we possibly could. You know, and there are a lot if you start to examine, and there are a lot even in, you know, places like Cambridge and, you know, the Russell Group and good universities everywhere. And we, you know, we showed, you know, we provided evidence that this is one of the major trends in higher education. And it's not opposed to, you know, you want to work with, you know, tech transfer, go ahead. But let's have some, you know, social transfer. Let's have some equal support, you know, for working with some of those other complex kinds of issues. And we showed them that a university of excellence in our university, if you want to be really excellent, you've got to be able to walk on more than, you know, one or two legs. You've got to be able to be part of systems of excellence, if you like, in a lot of different ways. And one of them is this engaged scholarship stuff. And It isn't the only trend. There's a lot of pernicious trends in higher ed. As I say, we all know it's a competitive environment, and the market has its ideas about what higher education should be and how it could better serve the market. If you just get all these liberal education and adult education, philosophers, all these people, historians out of the way. But we're not letting that happen. We're not dead yet, and there is a space right now to have a good conversation.
Yeah, I'll come back to you. I would agree, if I may make a comment. I would agree with that. And the work that I mentioned earlier that we're trying to do in the U21 network is very, very much around that. It's to a certain extent being able to do these things, but doing them within some of the rules that these institutions have. In as much as, yes, you can do those things if you can demonstrate what the reputational benefits are, what the economic benefits are, what the social benefits are for the different players, and if you produce scholarly work that comes out of it. And it's perfectly possible to produce very good scholarly work. That's the big measure. And Dave will be talking about the research enhancement framework, where we have to produce 4 internationally rated publications. There's no reason why people can't produce 4 internationally related publications from scholarly work that they do with communities.
Jim Crowley, University of Edinburgh. You know that I'm really broadly sympathetic and with you all the way, and always inspired by your presentations. There's kind of so I'm thinking aloud here. It's a question around what is knowledge democracy. And it seems to me that universities are really difficult places to think about knowledge democracy, because they're based upon, in a sense, specialized, elite knowledge. If we think about democracy, we think about equality, knowledge democracy. Does it mean equality of knowledges? Now, that's not to say, clearly, there's lots of knowledge out there. It's never just the kind of a resource of the university. But I'll give you an example. A few years ago, we produced, there's a new Scottish Parliament. We contacted, this is myself and colleagues, we contacted about 60 academics across the University of Edinburgh, and we asked them to produce a 2,000-word paper on their kind of subject specialism, whether that was philosophy, medicine, the whole range, across nearly all the faculties of the university. And we said, produce this paper and relate it to the issue of democracy, and write it in a very accessible way. But in a sense, that was to have a dialogue. And dialogue seems to be different from democracy, or is it? So I'm just kind of, what does that kind of term actually mean, knowledge democracy? Is it sort of just kind of sensible, there's a whole range of knowledges that come to bear? Is it, does it recognize a kind of that specialist knowledge within the university, which in a sense is what the university is good at?
Yes.
You know, so it's just really kind of explore that one a bit more. Yeah.
You know. Thank you very much, Jim. As usual, a terrific question. I'll give you the example of this group in France that some of you may know about, and I think you've heard of, Jim, the Science Citoyenne. It's, citizen science. It's very clearly, it sees itself in the midst of the what they call the science democracy movement. They are part of the Living Knowledge Network, which is part of GAYSR and which was part of the conversation that Mike and I had. What they do, what they are interested in their movement are two things. One is they're interested in stimulating public engagement in critical issues of science of the day. So those are the big capital S science that our universities are so good at and so involved in. But they what they're trying to get is democratic debate and discussion around things like nanoscience, genetically modified GMO, what's the O stand for? Organisms. And those kinds of science issues that in some ways the science establishment, the elite scientists, might prefer to have as a more closed conversation. So democracy in that sense means opening up, the debate to public engagement. A second thing which they do, which they're the only group I know that does that, they protect. They exist to try and provide protection for scientists who speak out against what they see as unethical behavior. We had a scientist at Nancy Olivieri, the University of Toronto, terrific pharmacologist, who spoke out. You know, she discovered that there was some funny business around some of the testing that one of the big, pharmacological companies was doing. That same company, which is funding the medical school that she is a part of, and it was all hell to pay for it. It was a huge court case. We didn't have something like Science Citoyenne, but in France, that organization, it's a small organization, so it can't, protect everybody, but their aspiration is to protect what they call whistleblowers, who are scientists, accomplished scientists, but who see something which they feel is immoral or goes against, the broad social, what's accepted socially. I agree with you, but it's very interesting that when we started our little conversation at my university, it was all about, the whole conversation was about, mobilizing knowledge or making sure that the knowledge of, good knowledge, created by all of the university people benefited the society, and the assumption was that we just let it all loose. And a lot of people still think of it that way, but we've gotten away from that. We now call it knowledge exchange. So at least there's a recognition that knowledge begins to flow in other directions. And if you take some areas, I'll give you an example, a good example. We're doing some work on Vancouver Island around local food production and distribution. We've got a Canada Research Chair, very, very good, committed, capital S scientist who holds a chair in food security and health. He's done a lot of work on, on local food distribution, organic producers, and all kinds of stuff. He works with huge data sets, all the StatsCan, data sets on, on food and consumption. But he does not understand the mechanisms of the food local food production and distribution in Port Alberni, one of the towns on the island, or in Port Hardy, or in Nanaimo. He needs the knowledge, it's perfectly good knowledge, of the food action groups in those places in order to complete his knowledge. He's got big theories, he's got numbers, so he's got a lot of credibility, but it's hovering above the ground until he gets the connection with these food activists, these really basically food activists. So this is where, as Mike was saying, is we can actually have better theory. Those of us who work in things like adult education or community development or sociology, places, that are about people, we can actually have better theory as well as being more useful to each other, I think.
I'll call things to an end there. Let us thank Darlene and Bud for a very stimulating afternoon.